Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is how to successfully set up the WebSphere iLog Rural Team Server. Today's presenters are Frank Delporte and Alain Robert. Frank has over 10 years of experience working with JRules as a consultant and as a product expert. As a Level 3 engineer, Align provides services for all maintained versions of JRules. In this role, he focuses on assuring the quality of existing version by identifying problems and providing fixes to customers. With 10 years of experience using JRules, Align has built a deep expertise in this product and its support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Frank.
Hello, everyone. So the topic for today is how to successfully set up WebSphere Rural Team Server. So the idea is really to give you a list of the most common caveats, the most common problems you will find when you set up a Rural Team Server. So moving to slide number 2. We'll see the agenda for today. So it follows a somewhat chronological order, except for migration, but basically the idea is from installation to building full artifacts on Rural Team Server, we go through the most common issues that customers are facing so that you can as much as possible avoid them and have the best experience setting up RTS. So first we'll go through some the installation steps. Then, optionally, for some customers, there is a migration that needs to take place if you have some existing rule repository from RTS, but that only concerns people who have to do migration. Then, once you have a setup RTS, you need to configure the security so that your users can log in. And once they can log in, they can push and publish rule projects through synchronization into RTS, and then once the rule projects are in RTS, you need to build them so you can deploy. So that's the progression for this presentation. Moving to slide 3, we see that the main point in installation are the order of the modules, the database schema, some issues around data source creation, and class loading policy. So slide number 4. So this is at the highest level. Some questions we have are, in what order should we install the different modules of JRules? And here the presentation is about RTS, so it's highlighted it's in bold in this slide that there is an order that you need to follow. You will first install the core, which contains a Rule Studio and Rule Execution Server, then RTS, then DVS, and then any application server bundle that you need to install. So, for example, for 7.1.1, you would install the core, then the RTS, DVS, and then maybe WebSphere bundle 7.1.1. So that's the assuming you have a license for DVS and everything, but that's the order in which you should install the modules. Then there is added twist when you need to install a fix pack. Currently, we are at 7.1.1.3. There will be a 7.1.1.4 sometime. And the way you should install this is to first install 7.1.1. That is a version without the fix pack. And you would just install the core, then RTS, then DVS. Then you proceed to install the version 7.1.1.3. That is the fix pack. On top of that, so again, you would install the core, RTS, and DVS that you downloaded for that version. And then finally, you can install the WebSphere bundle or any application server specific bundle. Note that in this case, you did not need to install the 7.1.1. So that's the only twist although it wouldn't hurt to install that bundle of the first version of the base version. But here, this is a step you can skip. At least remember the important part is to remember that you need to install core, RTS, DVS, and then any app server-specific bundle. Moving to slide 5, once you've installed the product, one of the early things that you're asked to do is to create a database schema. So there are a couple of ways to do that. The happy path is to let RTS generate the SQL script and execute it against the database. There is no one standard SQL script because it is generated on the fly based on your rule extension model. That is, if you have, for example, custom rule properties and things like that, based on that model, the schema is going to be changed. It might have additional columns in certain tables. So that is why this is generated on the fly. And you have a couple of options to execute that SQL script against the database. You can either let Installation Manager do that, and that's the happy path. It works well if you have proper credentials to access the database. That is, if you have rights to create a drop table and things like that. If you are not sure about the amount of credentials you were given, I mean the amount of rights, then it might be better to forward the SQL script that you can download through the Installation Manager. You can download that script and forward it to your database administrator for execution. So as I said, it's good if you're not sure about how much rights you have. It's also good, for example, with DB2, that requires a 32K buffer pool to be configured. And if you are not sure how that is configured on the database, it is probably best to leave to forward the scripts to the database administrator. Now, as I mentioned, the SQL is generated based on rule extension model. That is, some of the columns are going to be generated based on the name of the properties that you came up with. Sometimes people come up with very long properties that they want to add on their rules. In this case, it's a good idea to modify the configuration of the rule extension model to specify a column name and a column length for those extra attributes that you define in your model. That way you can avoid any SQL issue if the name of your column is too long. That happens sometimes. We have that, I think, over 30-some characters with Oracle. We run into issues. So if you came up with a name that's a bit long, you want to make sure that you specify a shorter one that will be used in SQL 5. So that is for database schema. Moving to slide 6, once you have the schema, you want to create a data source. So we recommend that you use a non-transactional JDBC provider, non-XA. The idea is that the product has been mostly essentially tested with non-XA JDBC provider. So we really, and we don't, there is no need for a XA JDBC provider in the way that, that it is designed. So we really recommend you use a non-XA. And then another point, and that is a very important one. I think we have quite a few cases about this, is that by default, RTS is going to look for the tables in the default schema that your user has access to. That is, whatever credentials that you use to connect to the database that gives you access to a default schema. And that is where the tables should be. So depending on how you created the tables initially and who created them, that may or may not work. So that's a very important thing to make sure, is that in this happy path simple scenario, you created the table with credentials to the data source, and you configure that when you assign that those particular credentials to your data source creation as well. That is in the J2C connection properties to make sure that the security credentials used to connect to the database are the same. That way, when RTS looks for tables, it does find them in the same schema. Now, if you are not able to have both the creation and the data source creation be done by the same using the same credentials, then there is a way to configure that. That is a recent addition to Rule Team Server configuration, is that you can specify for a certain data source that the table should be found in a specific schema name. But by default, as I said, it goes to the one that based on the credentials that you provided. So bear that in mind, because we have many customers who sometimes think that table have not been created properly, and actually they just happen to be in a different schema. Moving to slide 7. So once we have the data source, there's an aspect of the configuration of the data source that is the connection pool. And we've had a few customers having issue with, in the morning, they would log into RTS, and the first person who logs in after this night of inactivity the first person who logs in would see an error. It would fail some data source related issue, and then the next time around it would connect and it works right away. And very often this is caused by the connection pool of the data source that is retaining connections in the pool that have become stale. So our recommendation is to make sure that the data source connection pool is configured to have a minimum of zero connections. That means with that minimum set to zero, it will not try to keep a connection up overnight for no particular reason than just to have it up overnight. And then first person comes in and reuse that, and the application server thinks that it's a valid connection, but somehow the network possibly has killed that connection. So this is one aspect, is the minimum connection. Then there is other aspects. If there is a firewall and it is configured for a certain time to kill idle connections, then you want to make sure that the sum of the unused timeout and the read time, that sum is below the timeout set on the firewall that sits between your database and the application server. So, but at the very minimum, to avoid stale connection issue, we recommend that you set that minimum connections to zero. Moving to slide 8. And this is another very common problem, that in the installation steps, if you miss that part, it's pretty much guaranteed that you will have a problem. It is the setting the class loading policy. So most of iLog JRules modules, when they're deployed, we recommend that they are set to parent last policy. That is called in Web here, that is called classes loaded with application class loader first. Okay, so start, use preferably the classes that are bundled with the application. So that's the idea, is whatever the app server provides, we actually prefer to take whatever we bundled with the module to make sure that all the libraries that are bundled there are used and according to what we tested. So, and a common mistake is to set that class loading policy at the wrong level, so to set it at the application level, for example, and that is not really useful. The important one is to set it at the web app level, so that you can see it highlighted in red, is that you want to go inside the modules of Routeam Server, and you will find one web module, and you want to change that class loading policy. Then, once that is set, there are still sometimes an issue that this setting does not get picked up right away by the application server. So there are situations where you need to restart WebSphere and clean the profile name /temp directory to make sure that this setting that you just made does get picked up. Moving to slide 9, we see what it can look like when this is not correctly set up, when this class loading policy is not set. You will likely have a faces related issue or a JSS stack trace. So you can see here that your browser is not going to display the welcome, the login page or RTS, but it will show maybe an error 500. And in your trace, in your log, you will find something related to JSF or faces. So that is usually a good sign that this is an issue with the class loading policy. So that was it, I think, for installation. Moving to slide 10. So that only concerns people who need to migrate an existing set of artifacts from a previous version. So migration, we see a couple of issues, one related to locale and another related to priority property. So the one related to locale on slide 11. So prior to the current version, that is prior to 7.1, the locales would be, most often they would be two letters only. For English, that would be EN. But since 7.1, we are now recommending and to enforce a four-letter locale throughout. That is EN_US, for example. And because you may have artifacts that are still using the two-letter locale, you can have some conversion issues. We've had that recently, that if there is not, if in the RTS there are some artifacts that are using EN two-letter locale and vocabulary that's using EN_US locale, there can be some conversions that are done on the fly that cause issue. So we recommend that you make sure that you use four-letter locales throughout. Make sure that, in particular, that your vocabulary files that you can see in RootStudio, make sure that they have the EN_US extension. That is, if that is your locale, and make sure it's for that locale. And we also provide, and there is a TechNote link, that we also provide a SQL script that will let you update the tables in RTS so that you can move from two-letter locale to four-letter locale. So moving on to slide 12, another issue with migration has to do with the priority rule property, because if you come from Rule 6, the priority property was an extension back then, and now it is built in 7. So it is possible that when you do migration, you see a priority underscore ext SQL related error. And usually the solution, if you have used priority before, is to, if you want to retain those priority values, is to give it that to give that property a different name, so that when it gets migrated in the Rule 7 environment, you have that old definition of priority that you can now convert and save back to the new definition of property that is now built in Rule 7. So there's a bit of a twist there, and there's a tech note that explains what you need to do in details. Moving to slide 13. So once you have a database, you want for RTS, one thing that you want to configure is the role mapping between your users and the roles that are built in RTS. So you want to configure the security. We'll see here what are the standard security roles and what are the steps involved in adding one custom security role. So moving to slide 14. So there are four basic roles that are defined in RTS, that is administrator, user, config manager, and installer. Those are useful to control the level of functionality that the user has access to. For example, there is a configure tab in RTS that you only have access to if you're an admin or a config manager, but you don't have access to that tab if you are an RTS user. So those roles are used as a functionality level that you give to your users and groups. And that, the mapping between your users and groups, it happens at the application server level, because this is following standard Java EE security. So this is very application server specific at that point. And you can give any number of users or any number of groups, grant them this or that particular role of RTS, and that will give them more or less access to the functionality of RTS. But then there is the aspect of giving more finer-grained access to specific rule artifacts. And that is not something that is done with these roles. Typically, if you want to control who accesses which rule artifacts, you want to come up with new roles so that you can control access to that. So that is what we see starting in slide 15, is how do we create a new security role. So, for example, we might want to have a role for pricing rule writer. That is a person who will be writing the pricing rule. And we can imagine that maybe there is one rule project or maybe a few rule projects that this role would be interested in and would be maintaining rules with. And then we can have a role for pricing rule reviewer, and that would be a different set of people who can have access the same rule artifacts, but maybe read-only. So that is just one example scenario. And the idea is there is at least three different spots where you need to configure the security. One is that you need to augment your deployment descriptors with these new roles that you've defined. You want to map your users and groups to those new roles that you've introduced, and then you want to let RTS know that you've come up with those new roles, and then RTS can give you the choice to configure the permission management for those roles and give access to certain rule artifacts based on the roles that the users have. So in more detail, we're going to see the three different steps here. Slide 16, the way that you would add your new roles to the deployment descriptors of RTS, there's a couple of files that are concerned, is the meta-inf application.xml and the one that is in the Team Server WAR, there is a web.xml file, and in both files you would add your security roles. So that is sort of standard J2EE configuration. Then on slide 17, you use your application server security configuration to map the users and groups to the new roles that you created. So in this example here, let's look, for example, at RTS admin. What we have is on the application server security, we have defined a user named RTS admin. And in this mapping, we're saying that this user should be an RTS administrator role, an RTS config manager role, and an RTS installer role. And we're also saying, looking at the last two lines, that any user that is member of the group pricing role writers is actually going to have the role pricing role writer. Same thing for pricing role reviewers. So that lets you configure a number of users on application on security side that will be mapped to a particular role that RTS knows about. And we also, if you look at the first line, we also make sure that all the users that are member of pricing role reviewers and pricing role writers are all going to be RTS users. So that gives them basic level of functionality of RTS, that is a user with the default number of tabs, that is without the configured tabs of RTS. And we have the example of one John Doe user. Then however many users you have, once you assign them, if they are part of a group, in this case pricing role writers, when they log in, and they will automatically be given the role of RTS user, because we see that this is mapped here, and pricing role writer in this case. So that RTS will know that what level of functionality to give to that user and what particular artifact he has access to once you've configured permission management for that. And that is slide 18. So slide 18, you let RTS know of the new roles that you came up with. So you go in Installation Manager and you add the new group, the new role actually, and that later on lets you go through the project security configuration and enable the security on the project and only give access to access to that project for people who have the pricing role reviewer role or pricing role writer role. So that is one way of restricting access to one project. And then you can have even more fine-grained permission management that RTS lets you configure. But at the high level, the creation of those roles here lets you decide and restrict which set of users has had access to which role project. Moving on to slide 19. So the next topic, once you have all users logged in, you want to be able to publish role projects to RTS, because by default, when a schema has been created, there is no role project in it. So, and that is actually, if you try to log in at that point, you will have an error message that says there is no project, and that's normal. You just need to publish a role project from RuleStudio. So, and to do that, you will be using synchronization. So we're giving a number of synchronization tips. So moving to slide 20. So tip number one is to always use a user with role RTS administrator to do the synchronization. That avoids any particular security problem if you don't have the right to do certain changes to RTS. So that's tip number one. Always make sure you're RTS administrator. The second tip is that if you will be using HTTP secure to secure the access to Rule Team server, then on the Rule Studio side, it's simpler to configure it to allow self-signed certificate, because we have a number of issues reported like this where people are having problem connecting from Rule Studio to an HTTPS Rule Team server. And this is the first thing to try is to simplify the setup really. Because there is a correct way of doing it, sort of where you retrieve the certificates and configure the security very properly. but that can be a little cumbersome. So there is a mode that is allow self-certificate that simplifies things somewhat. This is also very much configurable, so if you're still having issues, we also provide a custom protocol that you can configure to make sure that the connection can be established between RouteStudio and HTTPS. Moving to slide 21, some more tips about synchronization is that the way it is designed, the granularity of the transfers between RouteStudio and RTS is that of the top-level rule package. So the recommendation is to avoid having a single top-level rule package because that will have some performance implications that, you know, whenever there's exchange of data between RouteStudio and RTS, it will be a whole blob of all your rule packages because they are all under one top-level rule package. So our recommendation is as much as possible, as long as it makes sense, of course, from an organization perspective, to have at least a good number of top-level rule package instead of a single one. That will help avoid errors such as cannot find remote element of type rule package. That is sometimes when you may lead the system to run out of resources if you have a single top-level package. So there's a tech note detailing the kind of error you can get. Moving on to slide 22. So a very important aspect of synchronization is UUIDs. So that's for universally unique identifier. And that's really the identity of the rule artifacts on the RouteStudio side and RTS side. So those numbers are very important. They are used by synchronization to make sure to really identify the objects. So as soon as you have a different UUID between RouteStudio and RTS, then synchronization is going to consider that it's not the same artifact. So it is very important not to use refactor UUIDs unless you are redirected to or you found an APAR or a particular instructions that guide you to use that functionality. But most of the time, you should not be touching the UUIDs. That is, in most situations, you should not have to. Examples of problems that you can see with UID is that if you copied a rule outside of a rule perspective, then it's possible that the rule, you will have two rules that have the exact same UUID, and that's not possible because it's meant to be unique. That's why when you are in the rule perspective and you copy-paste a rule, although it's an identical rule that you get as a copy-paste, it is actually a rule that has a different UUID because it is actually a unique rule that is different than the first one. So that's one type of problems, is a conflict of UUID. Other type of error is that sometimes people use the functionality that is called refactor UUIDs inside RouteStudio, and that they do that maybe to sort of branch out to make sure that they can have several branches of the same project inside their workspace, that same RouteStudio workspace. That may happen if they have integration with source code control. And that is not a good idea because that when you refactor UUID, then all the objects have a different identity. And from a routing server perspective, then they have nothing to do with the version of the artifacts that are in routing server. So suddenly there is no way to sort of see the difference between the two because they are all, from an identity perspective, they are completely different. So moving on to slide 23. So we were talking about UUID. So this shows where you can see the UUID, so you can check if during synchronization maybe you're not getting the result that you expect. Maybe you can look and verify if the UUID is correct for the rule, for the artifacts that you're looking at. So in RouteStudio, you would look at the BRL tab of a rule, for example, and you will see in the XML definition of that rule, you will see a UUID tag. So that uniquely identifies the rule. And same thing on RTS side, there is an option to show a UUID column in the table that is displayed by routing server, and that lets you compare that the UUID is indeed the one you expect with the one in RouteStudio. Moving on to slide 24, That is to explain that the way the synchronization works is it's a three-way comparison. That is, you not only have the artifacts on RouleStudio side and the artifacts on RouleTeam server side, you also have the idea of a common ancestor. That common ancestor is basically a snapshot of the artifact at the moment you published it. That is that moment in time where the artifact was exactly the same between RouleStudio and RouleTeam server. And that common ancestor is used to detect if there was a change from RouleStudio side or if there was a change from RTS side. And based on that and the timestamps for those changes, it can decide whether a publish needs to happen or an update. That is, in what direction should the data go. And if data should be going in both directions, then it might be detecting a conflict. So that is the way the synchronization works, and that's what makes important the folders that are called .rtserver in your Roule project on RouleStudio, because that is where those artifacts, that common ancestor, is kept at the moment you publish the Roules. So that explains why maybe if you have a Roule project that you've published to RTS from one workspace, and then you go to another workspace and you think you have the same Roule artifacts there and you want to do a synchronization from there, and then you see a whole bunch of conflicts. And very often this is due to the fact that that other workspace that you started with does not have the common ancestor. So in the absence of the ancestor, it will detect a lot of conflicts. So that is shown in slide number 25. So this is the kind of thing you would get is that when you're missing the .rtserver folders, is that a lot of conflicts are detected. So you may get that window, that dialog, that detects that there are a lot of conflicts. And what it will attempt to do is a two-way difference instead of a three-way, but that is not the preferred way of functioning for RouleTeam server, and it will not be as efficient and as good as the three-way merge that is normally the way that synchronization is supposed to work. You have some more details about this on the tech note that's listed here. Moving to slide 26. So now that we have Roule projects in RouleTeam server, there is a number of things you can do to make the building of the Roule artifacts work or perform better. So slide 27. It, as with many build system, for example, RouleStudio or Eclipse, they build artifacts and they handle differences between projects and between different elements. Sometimes, depending on the changes that you've made, if you've changed dependencies, if you've changed a whole bunch of things, it is possible that the system needs to perform a clean build in order to build properly the artifact. So here, the recommendation here is that for some reason, you're trying to build your project in RouleTeam server and it fails, and it's sort of unexpected because it used to build properly before, but today, after those changes that you've made, it seems to fail on a number of Roules, then what we recommend is at least you try to clean the RouleTeam server cache. It's sort of the equivalent of doing a clean build in Eclipse, for example. Moving to slide 28. Now, this is about performance. If you have a large number of Roules, sometimes you are concerned over shortening the time it takes to build a Roule set archive. So one option that you have is to go in the project options and ask that the artifacts be built automatically. That is, every time a Roule is saved, it is built right away. That way, when you go to a Roule set extraction and you're about to publish a Roule set or a Roule app, that takes a lot less time because all the artifacts have been built already. So the only con of using this option is that the artifacts are going to be built right away. So for small Roules, it's really quick. for larger decision tables, then maybe at the moment you save it, it'll need to compute it and to build it on the spot. But usually it's a good option to have a build automatically that will reduce very much the time it takes to extract all set archive. And also about static analysis, that is an important feature that some people really want to have that enabled at all times, but sometimes it can be resource intensive to compute all the dependencies, and depending on the environment that you are doing this in, it may make sense to disable rule analysis if you want to gain some time and have a faster rule set extraction. So that doesn't apply to everyone, especially if you're about to publish the rule set to production, for example. If you do that, then you want as much checking as possible, so you want to leave that on. But if you're more in the test dev QA stage of deploying the rule set, then it makes sense to disable the static analysis, and that way the rule set archive is going to build much faster. Moving to slide 29. Another aspect of build performance is that you have an option to store the artifacts of the build in memory or on file system. So, and with larger rule sets, it can be resource intensive in terms of memory for the server to do that in memory. So that's why we have, and this is by default how it works, is it will build all the artifacts in memory, and that can be, depending on how much resources available on the server, that can be lead to a problem, and especially when a JVM starts running out of memory, it's not only running out of memory, but it's slowing down because it's doing so much garbage collection that it's slowing most operations down. So if you want to avoid that, you have the option to specify that the intermediate artifacts are going to be stored on the file system. And that is a configuration parameter that you can set. It's called teamserver.build.archive.storage, and you specify a value of file, and you will have that in on the file system. Moving to slide 30. Another aspect of performance is the checking on every individual decision table. And it can be, with large decision tables, the overlap and the gap check, they can take a significant amount of time. And sometimes, because they are on by default, they can take quite a bit of resource, but in reality, sometimes the table does not really need an overlap check or a gap check because the way that you built it, it's not really something that you need to have checked. So I'm not saying this applies to everyone, but the idea is if it's not necessary, then you can gain some good performance by removing overlap and gap check for the rules that don't really need it. Moving to slide 31. So in summary, we just saw a number of things that help you avoid the common mistakes or the common problems in RTS. The main things that I would highlight is don't forget the class loading policy on the RTS web module. That is a very common mistake that we get. Be mindful of the four letters locale that we are now moving to, and make sure that everything from your vocabulary file to your artifacts in RTS, all of that is using a four-letter locale. Make sure that you use and configure the right security role when you set up RTS. We definitely recommend that you handle UUIDs with care because they are very important for synchronization, as we said. And we recommend that when you face rule build issues, then that you consider tuning the rule build performance as we just suggested in the previous slides. So this concludes the presentation. Moving to slide 32, this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. So visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming webcasts. like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. Visit websphereusergroup.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up to learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. Joseph, I think we'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, Frank, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for questions.
And we have no questions.
Thank you, Jackie. I see that we have two questions in the group chat, so I am going to announce these questions verbally. The first question here comes from Sudeep, and his question is, can we change the UUID explicitly?
Hi, this is Alan. So, yes, we Sudeep, we can change the UUID. There is a command on the right-click in Rule Studio where you will have a refactor UUID command, and you can do change the UUID for the element that you selected.
Thank you, Alan. And the next question comes from Alberto, and his question is there a way to avoid loading artifact in RTS? I mean, is there some way like this assigned artifact group that will speed up the RTS?
Is this about synchronization? I'm not sure what the answer should be.
And Alberto just confirmed that this is in relation to navigation.
So that would be filtering in the Explorer, maybe? So creating your own smart view in RTS.
It's already sort of loading elements on. It's not loading up all the rules in memory of the server. It's sort of loading them as you go, as you drill down the tree. And so, as Alan said, if you have a smart view that just shows the elements that you want to see, that it, as you drill down that tree, it will only be loading the artifacts that you that makes sense based on that query. So it's already based sort of load on demand, would say.
Thank you, Frank. I just received two additional questions in the group chat. The first question is, will the use of non-SA connection source affect transactions?
No, all the transactions, all the operations with the database are transactional in RTS, regardless of the XA.
Thank you, Alain. And the next question is, how do you resolve conflict with respect to UUID, and does each rule has a unique ID?
Yes. So each rule has a unique UID. That's the role of the UID. So if there is a conflict, you need to refactor the UID that has a problem. So you use the command that is offered on the right click of the element that has the problem.
It's also that is sometimes if you, let's say, if you have done, you may also have done refactor UUID on an element that you did not mean to do. That is a common issue that we see, is that that menu now comes with a warning that you should not be doing it unless you're sort of directed to, because most of the time, I mean, your rule it should synchronize with RTS, okay, as long as it has the same UUID. If by mistake someone touched it or did refactor UUID with it, then maybe the fix sometimes could be to revert back to the UUID of that this rule originally had, so you can properly sync with RTS. But generally, as we said, generally you don't deal directly with you don't touch the UID unless sort of directed to by support or by some APAR. Is that fair, Anna, or?
Yeah. And the only thing is, most people copy files outside of the RuleStudio and find themselves in the situation of duplicating.
Okay. So that makes sense. In the slides, I mentioned that when you copy rules outside of the rule perspective, then the resetting of the UID doesn't happen. So what you end up with is two rules that have the same UID, and that's not good. So one of them needs to have a different UID. And in this case, yes, the refactor UUID is a good option for that second rule so that it can have its own identity moving forward. So that's a good use of refactor UUID, yes. Yep.
Thank you, Alain and Frank. We do have a couple of more questions that just came in. The first question is, with respect to slide number 19, is not using a top-level rule package to save bandwidth or to allow packages to synchronize and recover shipment error be experienced partway through without resynchronizing from the top-level package again?
No, it is about the bandwidth. It is because, we are sending everything that is under the top package. So it could be large. And take a long time to process as one element in RTS.
Thank you, Alain. And we will take two more questions from a group chat. The first question is, can UUID be changed manually?
Yeah, I think we already answered that. So it's the refactor UUID menu. So you can skip.
So at this point in time, we will conclude the presentation.